Good afternoon and welcome to Eov, the trial of God and man. Once again, for those who are watching at home, you can go to torontotorah.com/Tanakh to do something. I'm forgetting at this point. To see the roster, to see the roster of remaining classes, as well as to make a donation to sponsor the program. Okay, so the book of Eov, the book of Job, and actually my wife and I sponsored this in honor of the Beit Midrash. I spent 2 years teaching this at Shari Shemayim in a weekly class a few years ago. I see a couple of people who actually were there for part of it. And really, it's a book I have oddly fallen in love with, which you wouldn't think that someone would say about Eov, but it's true. There's a remarkable amount going on here. It's not the simple text which is sort of the initial approach that people make to the book, and I want to talk about it both in terms of presenting an outline and in terms of the trial of God and man, which I see here in the book. But let's go through the outline first, and I gave you a basic outline on the sheet to start out. The first two chapters are the story part of the book, and then the story disappears until you get to chapter 42 at the end. But the story is I think unquestionably intertwined with everything in the middle. You can't really separate it from what happens in the middle of the book. Elements that are in the story weave their way into the dialogues that are in the center of the book and then come back in the story at the end. So the story begins with God watching what's going on in the universe. He's involved with the Malachim. Satan is on the outs. Satan is not invited with the Malachim who show up at God's door for some kind of a gathering. And Satan shows up anyway. He crashes the party, as the Rambam puts it. The Rambam didn't say party, but the Rambam says the Satan comes in uninvited with a message for God, challenging the worth of human beings. And we're going to come back to the Satan's message when we get to the point about the trial of God and man. But the message essentially is, human beings are unworthy. And God says, oh yeah? Well, what about Eov? What about Job? And Satan says, come on. The only reason why Eov is loyal is because you give him things. He wins prizes. That's why. But otherwise, he wouldn't support you at all. And God says, well, let's see about that. And Satan says, let's see about that. And sure enough, humanity goes on trial as Eov, Job, is transported to what is essentially a parallel universe. It's a universe which looks just like ours, looks just like what goes on in the Torah, but it's not. In the sense that in the Torah we are promised repeatedly, you do good things, you get rewarded, you do bad things, you get punished. And in this universe, it's because you're good, Eov, that you're going to get hit. Right? The only reason he suffers is because he stands out, as he's introduced in the beginning of the book, as Tam v'yashar yirei Elokim v'sar meira. He is perfect, he's unblemished. He is righteous. He is God-fearing, and he stays away from doing evil. And therefore, he's going to get zapped. And he suffers first in terms of the loss of his family. He loses his children. He loses his wealth. And yet, he doesn't complain. And God says to the Satan, see that? All this for nothing. And the Satan says, sure, because you wouldn't let me hit him personally. You wouldn't let me injure him. Let me injure him. Then you'll see what happens. And God says, okay, but don't kill him. And at that point, the Satan strikes him with boils, this terribly painful affliction that degrades him and wounds him and causes him tremendous pain psychologically and physically. And at that point, Eov still is not willing to blaspheme against God. He's miserable. He's angry. But he doesn't make a statement against God. And his wife says to him, the only words she says in the entire book, she says, bless God and die. And bless is a euphemism, right? She says he should curse. He should blaspheme and die. That's her encouragement. And Eov rejects her comments. And then his three visitors show up. Now, one of the things that the Dot Mikra edition of Eov takes pains to point out, Amos Chacham takes pains to point out, is that everything in this book, everything Eov encounters, should be viewed as part of the trial. Meaning, his wife is not presented here as a three-dimensional human being. It's simply another way in which Eov is going to be pushed and tested further. The physical suffering is a test. Will he still be loyal to God? And then his wife's comments are a test. When your own wife says this to you, will you still be loyal to God? And the three visitors should be taken in that light as well. The three visitors are part of the test of Eov's loyalty. The three visitors are friends of his. They're good people at the start of the book, even though we come to hate them in the course of the book. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar come from far and wide. The book takes pains to say that. They hear about how Eov is suffering. They come from distant lands. They converge. And they're so shocked when they see him sitting on the ground, his clothing torn in misery, and that they don't even know what to do. They sit there for 7 days, unable to speak. And the Gemara says, we learn from them the practice of waiting when one visits a Shiva, one waits for the mourner to speak, is learned from them. But it doesn't comfort Eov. Eov, after 7 days, finally begins to speak and to respond with frustration, cursing the day that he was born. Now, worth knowing, this is a good point to interject it. I mentioned this way back in one of the earlier classes also. This story may not have happened. When we talk about Hosea and the first of the Treyasar classes and whether the story of Hosea with Gomer actually happened, so the same question comes up regarding Eov. Did this ever happen? If you take a look on your sheet at the first source, I'm not going to read through it here. This is just an excerpt from a longer passage in the Gemara that discusses the question of whether Eov actually happened. The first stage is for sure he happened, and we have to figure out when he happened. But then you get another view that says, no, Eov, lohaya v'lo nivra, he never happened at all. The whole thing is a parable meant to teach us lessons. And then the response in the Gemara is, but it says there was a man in the land of Uz. To which the answer is, yeah, that's the way parables work. You tell a story like that. And it goes back and forth in terms of whether he happened or whether he didn't happen. Then in the further piece in the Gemara, they ask, is he Jewish? Is he not Jewish? It's not at all clear. It's not clear that the story actually happened. It could be that Eov did not exist. The Rambam indeed is of the view, I brought it in source number 2, that this is a parable. He does not believe that this story ever happened. However, functioning within the book, we have to act as though it did happen. And we have to try to understand what it is that's going on and why it is that God would allow the best person on earth. That's what he's described. There is nobody better than him on earth. Why God would allow this to happen to him? Why God would not just allow it, but really make it happen? You can say the Satan hit him, but the Satan hits him because God says, you can do that. So fundamentally, you have to ask the question of why in the world God plays along with this. And that's something that we have to come back to. Right now we're just outlining the story. And I'm trying to keep myself from going too far into the early part of the outline. So chapters 4 to 26 are the debates between Eov and his visitors. After Eov expresses his misery in chapter 3, Eliphaz, who is generally assumed to be the senior among the three visitors, Eliphaz speaks up. And Eliphaz says to him, people who do good things get rewarded, people who do bad things get punished. I know it has come to me as a prophetic vision of the night that that's the way the world works, and therefore, yeah, I'm sorry to say, but you must have something that is separating between you and God. You should do tshuva. You should repent. If you come close to God, God will accept you back. Now, Eliphaz doesn't know what we know, right, as readers of the book, because Eliphaz didn't read the first two chapters. So Eliphaz doesn't know that, in fact, it's the opposite. All of this is happening to Eov because he's good, because he didn't do anything wrong. He thinks, I'm giving, you know, good, reasonable advice. As a matter of fact, he says to Eov, you know, I remember you used to give this kind of advice to people. When people suffered, you said they should be strong and they should approach God. So what's happened to you? Why can't you do that now also? Well, Eov is not happy with what he perceives as a lack of compassion. He doesn't like it. And he responds with a speech of his own. Up steps Bildad. Bildad tries a different approach. Now, you have to remember, Eov is an incredibly hard book to read. First of all, the language is very difficult. It's not standard Hebrew. a lot of words that are in this book seem to come from other ancient Semitic languages, so much so that Ibn Ezra actually says, did I put it on here? I did not. Ibn Ezra, in his comment to chapter 2, I think it's Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11, says that Iyov, as we have it in Tanakh, was a translation from a book in another language. He says it's not originally what we see in Tanakh, which explains a lot about the language. But it's a very hard book to read, and it's hard to see how the sentences in some places lead from one to the next to the next. And the result of that is that when you get to these dialogues between Iyov and the visitors, there are multiple ways to read their arguments. So I'm presenting you one way to read the argument of Bildad right now, but you should know there are other ways. So Bildad says to Iyov, you know, it's like a tree. Envision a tree which has roots that are all tangled up in the rocks, that are limiting their growth. And then the tree gets uprooted and moved and transplanted somewhere else. So you look at the uprooting of the tree and you think, it's the end of the world! This is terrible! But then the tree flourishes in the next place. So too, Iyov, things may look bad right now, but it could be that it's all setting up something positive for you in the future. That's Bildad's response. Unlike Eliphaz, who says you're getting hit for a reason because you must have done something wrong, Bildad says maybe you're not really getting hit. Maybe actually this is all part of a plan to give you something good. Well, Iyov isn't buying that one either. And so up steps Sophar. And Sophar, the third and apparently the youngest of the three, offers his own approach. He says, you know, divine wisdom is broad and deep. Arucha me'eretz midah, rachava miniyam. He says, you can't fathom all of God's wisdom. Clearly there's something that God comprehends about you, about the world, that requires that this happen. Whether you've done something wrong or not, I can't say. But it all fits with a divine plan. That's his vision. I think it's Ralbag or Mitzudat David who says that what Sofar is saying is that God doesn't just reward and punish based on your deeds, but also based on your potential. So it could be you're really good, but you could have been even better. And somebody else who you see do terrible things, but he doesn't suffer, it could be that it's because he reined himself in. He didn't do all the bad things that he could have done. And that's the argument that that Sophar presents. Iyov, again, is very unhappy. And he's increasingly unhappy as time goes by, to the point where he says, I want to sue God. But he also says, all of you, this is Iyov chapter 13, he says, all of you are lying about God. You are all idolatrous. You have created a vision of what God is that isn't true. You think you're defending God, but you're defending some false God. I'm the one who's telling the truth about God, and God will, in the end, say that I am right. That's Iyov's response. It's remarkable. He is on the one hand angry at God, and on the other hand fiercely protective of God. All at the same time. You see why this is such a remarkable book. Well, that's the first round of speeches. Then you have a second round. The second round focuses on the punishment of the wicked and why it is that people do bad things and they thrive. And the visitors become more harsh in their criticism of Iyov with each speech. And Iyov pleads for empathy. He says, that's all I want from you. I don't want you to explain why I'm suffering. I want you to give me a shoulder to cry on. That's all I'm asking for. But they are merciless. And you get a third round in which the visitors actually bring charges against him. And in this case, it's just Eliphaz and Bildad. Sofer doesn't speak in the third round. But Eliphaz actually says, you've done this wrong and you've done this wrong. He actually says, you've sinned in this way and that way, and it's all made up. We know it's made up because we read the beginning of the book, which said he's the most perfect person on earth. Iyov hasn't done all the things that Eliphaz is charging him with, but Eliphaz needs to protect his narrative. In Eliphaz's view of the world, if you're suffering, you did something wrong, and it simply must be true. That's his approach. Then you get, in chapters 27 to 37, these odd interludes. First you get the closing speeches of Iyov. He offers up this dialogue about, or this monologue really, about wisdom. And how wisdom is so hard to find, and it's distant, and it's valuable, and all that, but he says ultimately it's not going to bring you to truth. He summarizes his experiences. And then parachuting in out of nowhere is a fellow named Elihu, who seems to have been present the entire time because he quotes from some of the other speeches that have been made. But we don't know anything about him. No one talks to him. He doesn't respond to anybody. He just talks about God. He says, God communicates, God is benevolent, God's deeds are perfect. Exit stage left. And then, now that Elihu is out of the way, we go back to our story. And literally, there's no response. It's as though Elihu just like was a commercial break within the story. So much so that among the secular scholars who look at this and say it's not one book from one time, they'll say that that's actually something that was spliced in. That's their argument. So, in chapter 38, Hashem speaks. And he says, I have bad news. There can be no communication between us, even as he's speaking. He says, there can be no communication. Our worlds are too different. There is a wild part to this world, and he talks about beasts that are beyond human ken and beyond human control. There are wild beasts. They laugh at human civilization. And that's what I'm like. You can't relate to me. You can't understand me. I am from the world of the behemoth and the leviathan. I am not from your world. There's no communication possible. And at that point, Eov, in the last chapter, apologizes. Sorry, I misspoke. I shouldn't have said what I said. Then, God defends Eov to the visitors. He says, Eov was the one who spoke properly about me. None of you did. And if you don't pray to Eov to forgive you, I'm going to zap all of you. They turn to Eov and say, please. Eov indeed prays on their behalf. God ends the book by giving Eov great wealth and family. There's some debate as to whether this is a restoration of his original family or whether this is a new family. When you look at the story itself, the original part, when he lost his family, it said they died, which makes me think that these are new people. However, the wording in chapter 42 in sentence 10 is that God restored that which had been taken. He's restoring the captives, literally, which suggests that actually they were alive, they had not died, which would make me feel better about the book. So what's going on? Is he loyal? Isn't he loyal? God is defending him. He's bashing the visitors, but at the same time holds himself up as a defender of God. Did he win? Like, did he pass the test? Did he not pass the test? It's such an incredibly difficult book, so I want to try to frame this a little bit. The trial of humanity. As we started the book, God is watching what's going on, talking to the malachim, to these angels, and Satan, as I said, is on the outs. If you flip the page to source number 4, you see I brought you from the Rambam, where he says it. It didn't say the Bnei Elohim and the Satan came to stand before God, which would have indicated that all of them were in one relationship as equals. It says the Bnei Elohim came to stand before God, and the Satan was also among them. This is what I mean about crashing the party. Language like this is stated only regarding someone who is not intended or invited personally. The Malachim show up to talk to God, and within the Midrash, this is understood to be Rosh Hashanah. It's a special day for the Malachim to report. And Satan comes in to say, human beings are bad. He says, wherever I go, business is good. That's what the Satan says to God. Mishut ba'aretz, I traveled everywhere. Says Amos Chacham in source number 5. Brilliant. Lo kara Satan b'shem makom mesuyam. Satan did not name a particular place from which he had come. The nearest Shakavanasa Lomar, what he meant to say was, I'm not coming to tell you about a particular sin that occurred in a particular place. Ha ha, God, I found evil. The whole land is filled with sin. Ki adam ein tzadik ba'aretz. There are no righteous people in the land. Satan's argument is, human beings are fundamentally unworthy. The world shouldn't survive. This is not Satan just taking a dig at God. It's a challenge to why the universe exists at all. Go back to the flood. The world is filled with Hamas. Go back to the Midrashim about creation, which talk about God's attributes, saying, don't create human beings. That's what's going on in Eov. What Satan says when he makes the claim that human beings can't do right is that the world doesn't deserve to exist. It should all go back to tohu vavohu. God should destroy the world and start again. And I see it. I see that as the reason why God takes up the challenge. It's not simply a bully game here, where Satan says, no one's good. No, I can prove to you someone's good. Look, I've got Eo, he's my champion. No, it's, can human beings be worthy? Can human beings do right? Can human beings be loyal to God? And if you think back to the flood, what is it that triggers God's statement that he will not flood the world again? No, the statement that he won't flood the world again. When Noah brings a carbon. Noah brings a present. Noah says to God, everything you see is mine. Because I single-handedly, with the help of family, fine, supported everything on the boat. Right? It's all mine. And yet, I surrender it to you, God. That's what Noah did. And God says, okay, there's somebody worthy here. Human beings can learn. The world will proceed. I'm not going to flood it again. That's what's going on with Eo. We're looking for another Noah. By the way, they're mentioned together in Yechezkel, but that's another story. And so humanity goes on trial. Can a human being be loyal to God? But Eo turns the tables. If you take a look at chapter 13, it's page 1637. Eo turns the tables in this trial. Chapter 13, sentence 17. Listen to this. He says, I'm just going to work with the art store right here because of time. Hear well my words. Let my expression be in your ears. I have arranged my argument. I know I will be vindicated. Who is he that would contend with me? Were I to keep silent now, I would expire. You know what? Reading it out of the English doesn't help. But in the Hebrew then, you notice the words that he uses. Look in particular at sentence 18, Pasuk Yud-Chet. Arachti mishpat. I have set up litigation. Yadati kiani etzdak. I will be tzaddik. Tzaddik does not mean righteous. Tzaddik means the winner of a case. The one who wins in court is tzaddik. The one who loses is rasha. Beitzdiku et hatzaddik in numerous cases in Tanakh where it's used in this way. He says, I am going to win. There is going to be a trial. Mihu yariv imadi. Riv. Ki yariv bein anashim. It's an expression of litigation. All of the terms here are associated with litigation in Hebrew. He says, I wish to sue God. I want to sue. And my challenge is God loyal? That's what Eov wants to know. Is God loyal? And he sets up two rules for the case. He says, God, number one, don't harm me. Let me speak my peace. Number two, don't frighten me, don't intimidate me into silence. And then I will make my claim, and he goes on to make three claims. Number one, I am no sinner, I've done nothing wrong. Number two, I'm insignificant and so unworthy of your attention that if I had done something wrong, why would you even bother punishing me? And number three, I'm just a human being. I'm here today, I'm gone tomorrow. Why waste the effort of zapping me? And then he builds in his insistence in chapter 16. In the interest of time, I won't go through it, but you see the reference on the sheet. You can look at it yourself. He says, I am innocent in my deeds to others. I am innocent in my relationship with God. And he calls earth and heaven as his witnesses. Normally, for whom are earth and heaven witnesses in the Torah? God. I call heaven and earth as witnesses. That's the norm in the Torah. Not in this book. Eo says they are my witnesses. They are on my side. Because they know that I am telling the truth as I argue my case before God. And the visitors' voices grow stronger and Eo's voice grows stronger in this trial of God. Now the truth of the matter is, questions like those of Eo appear elsewhere within Tanakh. I mentioned Habakkuk in one of the Triassar classes as an example of it. And it reminds me of the Gemara in Gittin, which I brought you in source number 7, in which Bar Daroma is a Jewish warrior defending us against the Romans. And his mouth causes him to stumble when he says, God doesn't go out with our armies. And the Gemara asks, but didn't David HaMelech say that? That's a pasuk in Tehillim. And so, yeah, there's a difference between asking it as a question and making it as a statement. But Eov is very strong and frankly more like a statement. He says, God has harmed me. I am being treated unjustly. But then at the end, when God speaks to him, that is a sign of loyalty. Eov takes the fact that God is going to communicate, even though the communication from God says there is no communication, right? Effectively, God's communication says you can't really understand what I'm going to say to you. Nonetheless, that in of itself, Eov takes that as a sign of loyalty from God. And he says in chapter 42, my remarks were foolish. I misunderstood. And yet you still communicated with me. And he quotes God, saying, I didn't know what I was talking about. God said, I don't know what I'm talking about, and you're right. I didn't know what I was talking about. I feel terrible. And I'm dust and ash, I'm disgusted with my hubris, and I regret it. At which point, Eov ends his trial of God. He says, you know what? I'm inadequate for this litigation. At which point, God ends the trial of human beings. Because he says, you know what? Eov has just proved that he's loyal. So that God says, I'm angry at the visitors. I rebuke the visitors because they didn't speak properly. Eov has spoken properly. Because for all of his anger, fundamentally Eov was loyal. What he was loyal to was loyal to an ideal. The fact that Eov gets angry when he believes himself mistreated shows that he believes that God is supposed to be fair. And he is loyal to that vision. He says, you're not living up to it. Think Abraham at Sodom. God, you're not living up to the God you're supposed to be. That's what he's doing. But he is fundamentally loyal to that vision of God. And therefore, Hashem says, I win. Satan loses. The trial of man is over. And he calls Eov a magic term. He calls Eov Abdi, my servant. Who gets to be an Eved of God in the Torah? Moshe. Yeshua, at the end of his career, gets the title of Eved as well. It's very hard to get the title of being Eved of God. It's a very short list. But God says, he is my servant. He's loyal to me. And that, to me, is the beauty of the book. It's an incredible read. It's very difficult. But you see there this question of the worth of the human being. And the human being challenging, is God going to reciprocate for us? And to close with the same question I've used in all of the classes that I've done, how does this book affect my relationship with God? I think, first of all, a sense that there is a purpose. However unlikely it seems, at the end of the day, there is a purpose to what happened. But also, there's an optimistic confidence that God has in human beings. Right? As presented in the book. The confidence in our capacity to endure and to be righteous and to be loyal, to me, is something that is very encouraging. We're going to pick up now with, well, now we're going to have mincha, and then we pick up at 5 o'clock with the next class, which is Shir Hashirim. Right, that makes sense. Shir Hashirim by Adam Friedman will be at 5 o'clock. We have mechitza here, so the women can daven there, the men can daven here. Thank you very much.